I think we're on. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Metal Hammer Podcast, episode 132. Testing out on a slightly different platform today from our usual recording situation. So if it sounds slightly different or whatever, I don't know if it will until we listen back to it. So we'll find out, I guess. But basically, I accidentally KO'd my work laptop last week, so it's been very stressful and everything's gone terrible. But we're back on the air, lads. I'm here with Metal Hammer Reviews editor Jonathan Seltzer. How are you doing, Jonathan?
Apart from coming to the end of a stinking cold, I'm all right. Can you probably hear me a little bit nasally? But I will plow through.
Good to hear. Oh, I'm Mel, by the way. I can't remember if I said that. I'm also joined by Metal Hammer contributor legend, Stephen Hill. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm right, Matt. I was hoping you were going to go, it might sound a little bit different. How you doing, L? And then I was going to chime in. That would have been a funny, I think that would have been a fun thing that people could have enjoyed at the start.
Should have written that down really quickly and held it up so I could have ad-libbed. But
yeah, should have done. But hey, you know, it's just what happens in these mad times.
It is. These are indeed, as people keep telling us, crazy times. Anyway, look, I'm excited. Who cares about technology-wise? I'm excited because we've got a brand new issue of Metal Hammer that is out right now. We are recording this on Thursday. It is out in shops as I speak. Shops across the UK and also available online to pick up from tinyurl.com/gethammer. Slightly different address than usual because we've changed our magazine platform that you order our mags from. So tinyurl.com/gethammer to get the new issue and all our other issues. We have the one and only Corey Taylor on the front cover this week, featuring a banging piece of artwork by Tom Newell, who's done a couple of things with Slipknot and Rammstein for us before. Looks absolutely splendid. Great feature by Danny Levers with Corey about his, quite frankly, bananas last few years and how he's managed to come to some kind of happy medium, which isn't really a situation you often associate with Corey, but it's a really, really great interview. You should definitely pick it up. Also, on a more somber note, this new issue also features our tribute to Power Trip's Riley Gale. It was something I wrote, actually, so I hope it kind of did the guy a bit of justice. And obviously, a lot of our subscribers will already know that this month's subscriber cover is dedicated to Riley. So I know a lot of you have been talking about that and celebrating Riley's career with us, which is awesome. There's loads of other stuff in the new issue as well. We've got a big piece on Black Sabbath's Paranoid turning 30. I wish it turned 50. obviously, the album that made them absolutely fucking massive and one of the most important heavy bands in history. We've also got a great piece with Deftones that L wrote, looking into why they decided to return to the place where they last recorded music with the much missed Chi Cheng. So that's a really interesting and emotional interview with the Deftones guys. And we've got stuff with Iron Maiden in there. We've got Jonathan's review of the new Marilyn Manson album in there. We've also got Jonathan's excellent feature with Enslaved in there. We've got a piece on Svalbard in there. We've got Bloodywood in there, Alice in Chains, Ginger, all the good stuff. Only in Metal Hammer this month, and it is out right now. So if you like the sounds of all that, go and pick it up, please. I think that just about sums up, doesn't it, boys? Happy days.
I think so.
Hey, yeah. Thanks. It does. I've not seen it yet, so I'm looking forward to seeing it. Didn't mention any of my stuff in there, but whatever. Not a problem.
Well, what have you got in there? What have we got? Let me have a look.
Can't remember, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You do have a lot of stuff on this issue, Steve, so you might stitch yourself up there.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I'm looking through now. It looks awesome. We got, Big People versus Tatiana from Ginger. That's quite interesting. We've got Slaylist. And then we've got Life Lessons with Mr. Adrian Smith from Iron Maiden, one of the greatest metal guitarists ever. Some of your faves, Steve, Palm Reader in the studio with them, written by Rich. Yeah, all the good stuff. Can't see a lot of Steve in here, though, so you'll probably have to go to the reviews to see what stuff Steve's been enjoying this month, basically. It is very good, and it is out now, so go and pick it up. That's the last plug, I promise.
On brand, Steve, review the Deftones album for this issue.
Sorry, say that again. You've gone a bit bleepy, Jonathan.
Steve did review the Deftones album for this issue.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I did. There you go. Yeah, well, worth it just for that, isn't it, really? The Deftones album. You don't have to buy it. Don't worry, I'm not upset. Like, it's still good.
Yeah, spoiler alert, he quite liked it.
Yeah, I for one was shocked. But yeah, go read all that. Go do it right now. It's really good, we promise. Metal news this week. There's quite a lot going on now. Feels like there's more and more stuff happening all the time, which is great. Corey Taylor is doing one of them live stream things that we've heard about. He's going to be performing songs from Slipknot, Stone Sour, and his quite frankly bonkers debut solo album, CMFT, a special gig live stream from the Forum in Los Angeles on October 2nd. Legendary venue, that is. Tickets for the event titled Forum or Against Them, available now from Corey's website. A very limited number of one-on-one video chats with Corey Taylor are also available with some ticket bundles. So you can get an actual video chat with the man himself, Corey Taylor, and a ticket to his, what I imagine will be pretty spectacular live stream show on October 2nd. Good for him. What do you make of this? These Ramstein rumours, Steve?
Well, I'm pretty surprised. I mean, if the rumours that they're going back into the studio are correct, I mean, they're not a band who are prolific in making records, are they? So, and what was it? Last year was the Ramstein, self-titled Ramstein album. So I just assumed, I think like most people, that we were looking at the next decade probably before we got another Ramstein album. They're one of those bands who, much like Tool, are very energetic and only put out material on their own terms. But for them to go straight back in the studio, I guess since they're not touring, they've got plenty of stuff to be. They've got to do something, haven't they? So it's cool. Like fucking great. I mean, new Ramstein. Who doesn't want that?
Yeah, I mean, it would be a massive surprise if they are working on something. Drummer Christoph did recently say that the band had been working on new material, but you kind of take that with a pinch of salt, don't you? Because bands are always kind of writing bits and bobs here and there. It doesn't mean they're necessarily producing anything. But yeah, old Ramstein World, the Ramstein fan site, said they're all been spotted in the French town of Saint-Rémy-de-Provence, which is where they have previously recorded. It was actually where they recorded the album from last year. So unless they just fancy some little holiday trip down memory lane, it's probably quite a good reason that they're there, I reckon.
So yeah. There's only six of them as well, so they're allowed to sort of hang out together, aren't they?
Yeah, true. Yeah. Good point, yeah.
So they can hang out.
That's in England, yeah. I don't know what the rules are in France.
But the fact that it's not in Germany, in the native Germany, that it's in France, means they're probably not going to be in the studio for like the next 10 years and do a Guns N' Roses.
Very true. Good point. You know, they need to get in and get it done, I imagine. We'll see. The thing is, in a weird way, it would be quite Ramstein-esque for them to do something that unpredictable and just go, oh yeah, here's a new EP, whatever.
Well, the thing is that is the one thing, I suppose, about this whole year and all with the shit that's happened this year, it has meant that we've got, like, a few people have just gone, well, fuck it, I'm going to release a record then. Like, I'm not just going to sit around who are meant to be touring. I mean, probably that Taylor Swift album, I know not very on brand particularly, but that Taylor Swift album that came out a few months ago was due to her just being sat around going, well, I can't tour and all my plans have been waylaid, so let's just do an album. And if you get a load of bands who think, well, we should do something this year, really all they can do is write, record and release new music. So, I mean, if we get a new Ramstein album out of it, I was about to say, maybe it would all have been worth it. That's definitely not true. It wouldn't have all been worth it, but it will be like, you know, a silver lining to still a massive cloud, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. In more new stuff happening that we should be excited about, Hatebreed will release their 8th studio album, Weight of the False Self, on November 2nd through Nuclear Blast. You can hear the album's title track right now. It is very Hatebreed-y. We love a bit of Hatebreed, don't we? Can't go wrong there.
I love Hatebreed. So good live as well, too. I love the fact that when they play live, they don't have set lists. They just go, Jamie just goes, right, he'll play this track, and everyone knows how to play it straight away. Like they just make all their set lists up on the spot. I saw them last time. I saw them was at weirdly at Inferno in Norway in front of loads of black metal fans. They all loved it.
Awesome. Yeah, I bet.
I mean, how can they just cross all boundaries because they're so genuine.
Mm. I mean, I'm pretty interested to see what sort of direction they're going to take on the new album. I'm wondering what sort of new influences that they've been bringing into their sound. I wonder what it's going to sound like. Any ideas?
I predict thuggish, brutal metal, metallic hardcore riffs over banging breakdowns, and Jamie Jester going over it a lot because he's one of the best frontmen in metal, and that's all I need. Do we don't need more from Hatebreed, do we?
Well, maybe this is their country influenced COVID album, lockdown album. Maybe he's spending a lot of time in lockdown, you know, being introspective, and they'll surprise us. And the song's just a red flag.
I reckon after the spat he had with Churches, I reckon he's going to go. I reckon he went there and listened to him. He's going to make an electro pop album.
Did he get a spat with Churches?
Yeah, wow. He had a little spat with him last year, didn't he?
Oh, I don't know what side to take. I love Churches.
I think we talked about it on the podcast, and I think we just kind of came to a mutual thing of Churches are good, metal's good, yeah. It's all fine. I think it was something to do with Churches getting billed above them on a festival or above another metal band, wasn't it?
Deftones. Yeah, they were supporting Deftones, and Gojira were below. So it was Deftones, Churches, Gojira. And he was like, oh, Gojira, you're going to get blown off stage following Gojira, which he's got a point. But yeah, most people do, to be fair. But yeah, I mean, yeah, you don't have to take a side. They're both really good.
It does seem to be Gojira.
Churches.
Not to, I love Churches, isn't it? Great. Not to kind of dig up what is now an old issue, but it does seem to be Gojira more than any other band that really provokes this thing of like, they need to be higher on festivals, they're bigger. Like, I don't know if it's, maybe they're bigger than we think they are, or they're not as big as other people think they are. But they do seem to be the one band that everyone always kicks off. Like, why, you know, the same with the Download lineup. People are going, why aren't Gojira headlining? Like, they've obviously got a very significant and particularly vocal fan base when it comes to this kind of stuff. And it makes me very interested to see what they could do on this next album, because it is a big album for them, no doubt about it.
But if you've seen the recent tours and you've seen the production values of those tours, they are totally festival headline band. And maybe you know, festivals can sometimes be a bit conservative, and maybe Gojira just being underestimated, and I would err towards that side of things.
But also, you've got to think, ultimately, they are a death metal band. I mean, a festival like Download that's getting headlined by Kiss and Aerosmith, and you're expecting a fucking French death metal band to headline it, as great as they are, and like nobody would love to see Gojira headline that festival more than me. But I mean, personally, I can't see it, because at the end of the day, they are still basically an extreme metal band. And they're very, very challenging. I think to your general kind of common or garden rock fan, that's a big ask to go, or go and listen to, like.
I don't know about Bloodstock and Download. Plus, you need to start preparing the ground for the next wave of headliners. And I mean, apart from them and Ghost, I can't really see, you know, I can't really see anyone else who has that and the credibility to be a festival headliner. So you're going to have to start taking a punt and taking a risk. And I think sometimes UK festivals can be a little bit risk averse compared to continental festivals.
I think that's probably fair. I mean, you know, I think Gojira just, I'm sure in some ways maybe they're not, but I feel like Gojira, I wouldn't put them on the same level as Ghost instead, I do feel like with the right lineup on that next album cycle, Ghost could headline Download. Like, if you had a big band on the Saturday or something, like a Metallica sized band on the Saturday, and you had like a really good, whether it's Metallica do have a lot of classic rock bands, but you know what I mean? Another kind of solid big name on the Sunday as well. I do think you could stick Ghost straight on that Friday headline. I do think they're going to be at that point next year. You know, they've just done an arena tour. Like, they're there, really. They're as there as they're going to be. Whereas Gojira is still, you know, don't quite sell that many tickets. And like Steve said, they are heavy and challenging. I know we've gone on a weird tangent from Hatebreed, but there will be new Gojira music next year. So I think if they're going to be able to make those moves, and, you know, fucking hell, it certainly wouldn't be the weirdest thing that has happened. There are definitely Gojira songs out there which you could probably play someone that would be less offensive to their ears than some of Slipknot's heaviest stuff. Do you know what I mean? So I think, you know, we'll see what happens on this next album anyway. All we want is new Gojira.
Yeah, it'd be amazing if they did headline. Amazing. I mean, that would be, yeah, that would be great. But I mean, you're right. I can see it more. I think Ghost are a shoo-in, surely. Whereas Gojira, it's up in the air still. They sold out Brixton Academy, and they're definitely in the pot. But I think like Ghost has to be.
I feel like it's like every generation of metal has like, you know, Hatebreed fit into this a little bit. There's kind of like a people's metal band, like a kind of a band that the people of the metal world take to their hearts, and there are bands and there are guys. And like Metallica was one, Pantera would definitely one, Lamb of God were probably one, even Five Finger Death Punch were one. Do you know what I mean? They're not like the coolest band, they're not the most maybe celebrated by the media, but they're the band where your average metalhead that just likes metal fucking goes, yep, them. And I think Gojira are in that bracket. So they've definitely got the goodwill for that. But we'll see what happens anyway. So that was our download future roundup. but let's go on to more pressing and immediate matters. Now, I have to confess, in a rare cock-up, I've not been able to actually listen to this week's album of the week because I haven't had my proper laptop with me. And so I haven't been able to hook up the shonky little one that I was using instead to a good stream where I could blast it properly through headphones and blah, blah, blah. But luckily, I have with me two of the most foremost experts on this next band in our field who will have plenty to say about it, because we're going to do the new Napalm Death album, Throes of Joy in the Jaws of Defeatism, one of the most important, influential, vital British extreme metal bands of all time. Jonathan, before we get stuck into this album, do you want to kind of briefly talk about where Napalm Death are kind of at? Are they just kind of at the point now where they're just a respected band, putting out new albums every so often, and that's good enough for what?
Yes and no. Only in the sense that that's what, you know, if that's what kind of maybe people think they're about, but they're still challenging themselves and you with every album. I think when people, they just respect the band, they're thinking of like the first few albums that they just, they're always going to do the same thing. But, you know, then they went off and did those two albums that weren't kind of very much in the typical Napalm vein. They came back with Enemy of the Music Business, which was kind of quite avant-garde, but kind of also back to the, you know, what you could call the classic sound. But that classic sound ever since has been mixed in with some, with a lot more kind of experimental stuff. So in the same way that you were saying like early on, oh, what are we going to expect the new Hatebreed album? You might think that about Napalm Death, and you'll always actually get the unexpected. And I think this one particularly is the most diverse, one of the most experimental, and one of the most awesome, brilliant records they've done since Enemy of the Music Business. And they've done a lot of great records since then. So to answer that question, yeah, they should be respected more for, for being kind of a lot more experimental than they are. But when they experiment, it's still very Napalm Death. Like they incorporate lots of old influences, like you can hear Swans, but they're not trying to sound like Swans. It gets incorporated into what Napalm do. So it becomes this weird sort of hybrid that's still Napalm Death, that that's still pushing boundaries. And it's a thing with bands that were pioneers, whether in grind, whether it was them or Carcass, or in thrash when it's the early thrash bands. You know, the bands that pioneered those genres or subgenres, they're not beholden to that one sound. So like Testament don't sound like classic thrash band now, Metallica don't sound like a classic thrash band now. Whereas if you're like Municipal Waste and you're trying to be a thrash band now, you're always going to sound like one period of thrash. Or if you're a grindcore band now, you're always going to sound like one period of grindcore. But the bands that started it, they have the license to keep pushing the form and expanding it. And that's exactly what they do. Steve.
I completely agree with everything Jonathan's just said. I think, and I really, really do mean this, I think if you put a list together of the 10 best, most influential, most important bands in the history of British music, I'm not even convinced Napalm Death are a metal band, to be perfectly honest. I'm talking Beatles, Radiohead, Black Sabbath, the very, very, very biggest, most important bands, Pink Floyd. I think Napalm Death, for me, would walk into that top 10. I think they are an absolutely phenomenal, incredible band. I feel like I was fairly lucky to get into to sort of discover Napalm Death, and I did because, I mean, I actually heard Breathe to Breathe on a Cover Mount CD.
Love that song.
Yeah.
So groovy.
Absolute banger. And so, you know, Inside the Torn Apart was, I think, as you mentioned, Jonathan, when they were going more post the kind of the grindcore years and when the life changed, and then they took on this sort of death metal form, and then they even kind of evolved that and it became a bit more groovy. They were touring with Machine Head. I think they were in between Machine Head and Cold Chamber on one tour 1 year. So, you know, they're not afraid to mix it up. And yeah, to come back with Enemy of the Music Business, which was, like you say, a kind of a return to, I guess, the quote-unquote classic Napalm sound, but with all of those other influences you mentioned. I mean, the amazing thing about Napalm Death is actually they're still being influenced by the same 10 bands, Motorhead, Discharge, Celtic Frost. You mentioned Swans, Killing Joke.
Yeah.
Sonic Youth. Like, they don't really have that many influences outside of a pool of just maybe 8 or 9 massively influential, incredibly forward-thinking transitory bands. But it's how they kind of evolve what they do with those different influences on every album, which I think is why Napalm Death, you get 16 albums down the line. And I'm, you know, this album's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And you sit there and you sort of think like, oh my God, I can't believe 16 albums in, I'm still hearing new things from this band. But, you know, after 12 albums, I was saying that. After 13 albums, I was saying that. After 14 albums, 15, I've been saying, you know, it shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone at this point that Napalm Death are continually pushing themselves. And like Jonathan says, still sounding like Napalm Death. I mean, there's bits on this album. I mean, I guess the main one that people would talk about would be Immoral, which was one of the singles, which really, really sounds like Killing Joke.
Totally. And
Napalm Death have definitely done that sort of post-punk, you know, Joy Division meets Celtic Frost meets Discharge thing before, but I don't think they've ever done it to the point where, like, Immoral, in a different world, that could be a single. Do you know what I mean? It's catchy, and they're an absolutely incredible band, and there's so much stuff on this record where you just go, it's so brimming with new ideas, but yet, like you say, it still sounds exactly, there's no doubt as to who this band are.
Yeah.
When you hear it, but yeah. I've still never heard stuff like, I mean, the closing track, which is a belly full of salt and spleen. Again, they released that, and it's not the sort of thing you would expect. Amoral, you know, that kind of doomy, almost sort of grungy, gothy core. It's not what people, like you say, when people think of Napalm Death, they go, ah, Scum. Yeah, our Scum. They're that wild, crazy, you know, 10-second long songs band. I mean, at the point, that is just, it's totally inaccurate as to what Napalm Death are. And this record is complete proof of that.
Yeah, I think like it's easy to mistake them because those early songs were so compact that. But also, what you have to understand is that the kind of the scene and the time, not that they just came out of, but what they grew up in. So, you know, Birmingham in that kind of mid-late 80s was a hothead of, like, really sort of interesting industrial music, like Godflesh, you know, obviously. Justin Baldrick was one of the singers for Napalm and went on to form Godflesh. And so there's a lot of that kind of 80s industrial kind of forming its way into it. So, like, on the new one, like, Je vois de ne pas vivre, it really sounds like something off the first Young Gods album, which is kind of like came out in 88, but, you know, Swiss band. But it's got that really weird, woozy, and it's like Young Gods, again, another band, so original that they were almost like impossible to kind of rip off and do it well. But somehow they've got the spirit of that. But you've also got, like, there's thrashy songs in there, like Contagion and Fluxing of the Muscle. And then also, like, you know, what you said about Napalm being so influential, there's one particular kind of groove. It's like all these grooves are like suddenly like bumping it, like a train's just suddenly stopped and all the carriages are bumping into each other. And you can hear it, and you can hear that one particular groove. And it's like in every kind of grindcore band since. And it's in there, but it's not as much as you'd think. And when they do use it, like, say, it's in there in, like, Zero Gravitas Chamber, it I think it's a Russ Russell producer. He always produces. Yeah. So, but now it's got a really spacious production, and it's not the grimy, dirty production that they used to have. And especially, so weirdly, Napalm Death sound really good on good headphones.
Yeah. They
would, yeah. So it's just, but yeah, the spaciousness of Russell's production just gives it kind of a room to breathe, and it just, yeah, just adds another dimension to it. And what I'd love to hear, but I didn't get it on the promo, is they've got two covers on the bonus tracks, which also tell you a lot about where they're coming from. So they've got a Sonic Youth cover, White Cross with a K, and a Rudimentary Peni cover. And that says a lot about where they're coming from too. You know, there's always like, you know, and it's so interesting, like kind of punk bands, but Sonic Youth were really innovative and angular, and took completely rewrote what it can do with music. And yeah, so just interesting that, you know, a lot of their influences are kind of from the left field avant-garde side of things.
Well, and I interviewed Barney, I've interviewed him a few times, and every time he says they think of Napalm more as a kind of art project rather than a band. They are thought of as this kind of ever-evolving thing that just take, like you say, all of the bands that Napalm would mention as influences, they don't, you know, it's apart from Motorhead maybe, it's not like any of them ever stayed in the same place at one time. They all kind of progressed massively. And I mean, again, one of the things to kind of touch on the extremity of Napalm Death, like this album is like fantastically heavy. Like it is, I mean, as you would expect from a Napalm Death album. Like, I mean, the first two tracks, Fuck the Factoid and Backlash Just Because, are kind of classically sounding brutal Napalm Death songs, and they're amazing. But they've got this thing about them where I think, you know, one of the real skills in extreme metal is to give people hooks. You know, like there are a few, all of my favorite bands within kind of extreme music, they can be as loud and angular and abrasive and heavy as anything. But if you can somehow find some sort of little hook for people to grab onto, then that to me makes a world of difference. You look at, you know, a band like Norsem, who obviously would have been massively, massively influenced by Napalm Death. And they just play, you know, 45 second long groovy grindcore songs, and their riffs are so catchy. And I think you listen to this, and the idea that Napalm Death are just this kind of warp speed, impossible to latch onto wall of sound, even within those first two songs, which are, you know, which are definitely that, they're so catchy. Barney's vocals are, but Barney is not just that sort of cookie monster, like formless cookie monster death metal vocalist. You can hear the words that he says. I mean, someone tweeted me about Napalm. I was wanging on Twitter about how great Napalm Death were the other day, and someone went, oh, I think Barney just reads his shopping list out and sort of barks over that. And it's like, well, one, he's got so much to say, and he says it in such an intelligent, articulate, thoughtful way. He's such a, you know, brilliant mind, that he's not going to let his lyrics just be nonsense for a start. And secondly, I think you can understand every syllable that comes out of his mouth. I think you can genuinely hear what Barney's saying. And I think, again, that is really rare in extreme metal to actually do that and still be, I mean, this is a cutting edge album. There's not many records that are going to come out that are going to be heavier, more extreme, more challenging than this. And they're, you know, they're nearly 40.
Also just really carry along and groovy. But also, I think like the clues about, you know, them, that, you know, that artistic art side of them, were they really early on? Like, look at all the bands like ex-members went on to do, like Godflesh and also like Total, you know, Zambient Projects and Jesu from Justin Broderick. Nick Bullen went on to do Scorn, which is this kind of dark ambient sort of project. Lee Dorian went on to do Cathedral, and, you know, they went off into kind of weird proggy realm. So it was all of that was in their DNA from the very start. It's just that, you know, when it starts off so distilled, like something that concentrated, it's actually got a lot of stuff distilled into it. It's not just, it's not, people mistake, like, you know, something that distilled for being simple, but it's not. There's actually a lot of stuff that gets distilled into You Suffer.
Yeah.
it's like a big bang. It's like there's all this genetic material in New Suffer.
Amazing. I think
brilliant record.
Yeah. It's going to be easily in my top 10, if not higher, this year, of albums of this year.
Always. If you do want something which is just really fucking heavy, by the way, are we moving on? Or sorry, Mel.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, no, I think that was a splendid.
Yeah, I just want to say that the new video for the... What's the final track called again, Steve?
It is called... Hold on. It's A Belly Full of Salt and Spleen.
Yeah, watch the video for it. It's done by Khaled Lowe, who used to be the singer from Passenger. Passenger? Yeah. Anyway, but the new video is amazing, and it's kind of a lot about the refugee situation, and it really gives the song another dimension.
Cool. Awesome. Good advice. Yeah, that is the all brand new Napalm Death album, Throes of Joy and the Jaws of Defeatism, out Friday via Century Media Records. And yeah, I think Steve made a very good point. Me calling them a legendary extreme metal band at the start of the review is probably doing them a bit of a disservice, because they are so much more than that. Steve, you had another band you wanted to give a shout out that's got a release out this week, didn't you?
Yeah, mate, there's this is a band called Fawn Limbs. The album's
like, what is that? How do you spell that?
Fawn, F-A-W-N, and Limbs, spelled Limbs, L-I-M-B-S. They're from Pennsylvania. The new album's called Sleeper Vessels. It's like 27 minutes long, so it's not a long listen, but you will probably be just drenched in sweat by the end of listening to it. They're a three-piece. I cannot believe they're a three-piece. They definitely come from that school of... I mean, we're talking about early Napalm, Meshuggah. I mean, really, like, they're broadly a sort of tech metal thing. Really, really broadly. But, I mean, I remember sort of hearing Dillinger on Calculate Infinity era Dillinger, Candiria, hearing Meshuggah for the first time. And I think it's fair to say in sort of, you know, 20 years post that stuff happening, that kind of mathy, jolty, weird, super noisy, lots of notes and, you know, polyrhythmic thing has sort of got a bit old at this point. That whole tech metal thing, it's kind of lost its edge a little bit. And I did sort of wonder, can anyone really kind of match up to those bands from that point? It feels like that was definitely like a roadblock. This album is unbelievably intense. It is kind of like Pig Destroyer meets Phantomas meets Candiria. There's so much going on. It's got like Aphex Twin style electronics over the top of these massive, like, The Art is Murder deathcore. But it's basically sort of like deathcore, some weird electro music, Animals as Leaders, and grindcore all being sort of stuffed into a blender and then just spat out at you as hard and as fast as possible. It's like hit by a baseball bat and getting stabbed and getting set on fire at the same time, is what I described it to my mate the other day. It is it's really good. And it's actually way heavier than the Napalm Death album. So if you listen to the Napalm Death album, you're like, boo, too many choruses. I can hear what he's saying. This album is a horrific listen. Horrific.
Okay, if I'm like Bowlby and
I was with you all the way until you mentioned That as Murder.
You know that kind of just really catchy sub drop like thing that happened that they do. There's a bit of that. I mean, I think they'll probably be furious that I mentioned That as Murder if looking at the band. But this
is there some beef about Thy Art Is Murder in the metal scene I'm not aware of?
No, I just don't. I can't stand them myself.
Well, they're just a bit basic, aren't they? Like, I love them.
It's just this pure testosterone thing, or just without any kind of anything else to balance it out. Nothing kind of larger. You know, I love straightforward testosterone music, but I like it to be, you know, have a bit of an extra dimension to it. This is just like pure sort of macho sort of jock posturing, really.
But that right low down sort of thing, they've got a fair bit of that on it. I mean, it's not a lot, not a lot really. Like, there is a lot of other shit going on, and I do think if you just want to get absolutely brutalized, then it's one of those records where you go,
fuck. Oh, no. Every other band you mentioned, I'm completely sold. I'm just going to just try and wipe out the Lightest Murder reference in my head.
Okay. So they're doing something kind of new. Like, they pushed it. Like, sort of them, and you know when the Imperial Triumphant album came out? And I sort of, fucking hell, I don't know if I can actually listen to this. It's just maddening. I got the same kind of vibe from...
The thing with it's like with Voivod, with Imperial Triumphant, you have to imagine the world it takes place in. And once you do that, it all falls into place. And, you know, so sometimes you just need the greater context. And then just like, oh, now I can see it. If you think about listening to Imperial Triumphant and you think about New York and you've got all this gold, and you can hear that kind of gold in some of the guitar tones, but the same with Voivod. If you think of this weird sort of apocalyptic world where everything's going a bit sort of out of reality and out of sync, then it totally makes sense. I didn't get those bands, but yeah, so maybe you know for this band, Four Limbs, you just need to see the bigger picture and then it will all fall into place. Context is all.
Maybe. I just want to listen to some fucking Dieter's Murder and Mosh. Is that all right with you?
It's all right with me, mate.
You do you, man. You do you.
Well, someone has to. Let's take some reader questions now from metalhammer.com, facebook.com/metalhammerreaders. Come and join the coolest community in metal. Jack Reed says, vinyl is outselling CDs for the first time since 1986. Is it sustainable? Do you think we should be doing more to help our bands financially? So this is coming off the news that was reported in a few American news organizations that, yeah, vinyl is actually starting to outsell CDs in certain, you know, areas and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
is it sustainable? Do we think we should be doing more to help our bands financially? I mean, I would say that buying vinyl is probably doing a bit more to help out bands financially, isn't it? That's probably a good sign that,
yeah,
that people are doing that. I reckon. What do you guys think?
I wonder, it's like, I mean, obviously CDs are selling a fraction of what they used to. I wonder if that says more about CDs than it says about vinyl. I think, yeah, vinyl is rising, but CDs are kind of going kind of in the opposite direction. Because why would you buy, like, you don't get the artifact, you get the, you can get like pretty good quality streaming. You know, I sort of think you should always support the artists in whatever your format you should do. If you like a band, you should own it. It gives you that much more connection to the band to have something physical in your hands. But that's, you know, I think metalheads were very analog. But yeah, I think that, you know, but it's a whole kind of lockdown thing. We've thought a lot about how to support our bands. You know, we've been buying, you know, Merlin's been buying loads of t-shirts. I buy t-shirts. You know, whenever I go on a stream, I've been buying special stream t-shirts like the Rancid Pazuzu stream they put out. And yeah, we're all sort of like, it's kind of bringing it home to us a bit more, like how much more we can support bands, you know, in the absence of live gigs. So I think, you know, we are. And like I said, yeah, having something in your hands gives something that much more meaning than just having it on a stream. It, like, you've actually gone actively out to get something for it, and it's not passive.
I think, like, you know, the sort of pros and cons of streaming culture are fairly obvious, really, aren't they? I mean,
yeah,
10 quid a month for owning, well, not owning, but being able to listen to every single band that I could ever dream of ever having wanted to listen to is brilliant, if a little daunting. But certainly, like, as you know, Merv, as we discussed a bunch of times, I spent quite a lot of money on vinyl and have done over the past couple of years. I did have a period where I didn't really spend any money because, like you say, Jonathan, CDs, I wasn't sort of excited. It's been a long time since I could get excited about buying a CD because I guess formats come and go, and when the, you know, vinyl's cool again now. Vinyl's actually like a cool thing that people want to listen to, and certainly, like, yeah, the idea of having an actual physical thing in your hand, I think certainly for people our age, since we can remember when that's all you could have, I think it puts a hell of a lot more value. It puts more value on the music as well. Like I listen to, there's a lot of albums that I only listen to when I stream them, and it's like, oh yeah, that's cool, but I don't. They're not in my head, as opposed to going upstairs into my room where I've got all my vinyl and looking through it and going, I love, you know, Failure or fucking Depeche Mode or Metallica or whatever I happen to pick out, and going, I love this band. I genuinely have a strong connection to this band, not just financially, even though I pay for them, but also they feel like one of my bands more. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, yeah, for people that grew up with physical product, definitely. But I think for younger fans as well, it gives them a kind of new chance to connect with music in a whole new way. Because, I mean, CDs were fine. And they were great for what they were at the time. But the thing with a vinyl is, like, if you're playing it through, you have to engage with it, because obviously you have to flip it to the other side every... And so you kind of almost, if you want to listen to the album, you kind of have no choice but to kind of be engaged with it, because it's not as easy to just put it on the background and leave it. And I think, yeah, definitely the physicality of it, the artwork, just the process of taking a record out of its sleeve and delicately putting onto the thing, the whole experience makes music listening an experience, which you can't really say is the same when you're just pressing play on a stream.
Yeah, I was just about to say exactly the same thing, that, you know, it's a bit of a ritual. And I remember, like, yeah, when I was buying CD, buying vinyl, you know, before the internet, and, you know, you put the needle on the record, and you know, even then you're kind of like forming a connection, you know, you're completing a circuit when you put the needle down on the record. But that anticipation, when you haven't heard any tracks from it beforehand, but you bought it on what you've read or heard, but that anticipation of the running groove was so exciting. And there's so much more dimensions to what you just said, that kind of ritual you have with vinyl. Definitely. And you know putting it out, you know, looking at, see what they've got on the inlay, reading the lyrics, pouring over the artwork on 12 inch on, you know, as a 12 inch canvas. Yeah, it's you can't, there's nothing really else to compare to it.
Yeah, it's the best. And I know you lads have been very good with all that. I was actually at Steve's house the other day admiring his vinyl collection. It's very nice. I know Jonathan's all about that as well.
Yeah.
Let's do more questions.
Before you move on, I think it's worth saying that although vinyl is out selling CDs, and I have no reason to doubt that it's not, but that is still, both of those things put together, I think, compared to the amount of people who do just stream music, is a drop in the ocean. And it ain't going to go away, but it is a shame that it's, like, it's so far ahead at this point. And I do think it, you know, it has cheapened the value of art too much. I think I'm all for, like, streaming music and having Spotify and making playlists and just casually listening to music occasionally with it on in the background while you're doing the dishes or whatever, but I do think it's sad that how much it appears to have cheapened the value of art in 2020.
And I think how proactive you are in how you sort of you get music kind of affects, like, how, what you listen to, I think, as well, too. Mm. That, you know, there's a kind of a generation of, like, Spotify bands who just have a bit of this and a bit of everything, and jack of all trades, master of none, because they don't really have an allegiance to one particular style or a genre or what the ideals were of that particular genre, what it stands for. So you're just kind of always skipping across things. And that's very much a kind of a streaming generation approach to music and to making music, I think, as well, too. That if you spend time with one thing, you start to, you know, the value systems of that particular genre or subgenre start to seep into you, and you interact with it. I think that's really important, too.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I know what you mean about the way people make, a lot of artists make music now. It's kind of like playlist mentality rather than album mentality. Sam Welch asks, me and Steve did the In Flames Hall of Fame. We should do another one then. I haven't done a Hall of Fame in a while. When you did the In Flames Hall of Fame, you recommended I think Sam asked a question at the time, asking which In Flames album is good to start with. And he says, you recommended I start my In Flames journey with Reroute to Remain. Thanks, by the way. Thanks to Spotify playlists. So that's one good thing about streaming. I've also started listening to Soilwork. What other bands would you suggest I try? I mean, if you're into the kind of the upper tier of melodic death metal, you want to get on Dark Tranquillity for sure. I would highly suggest Damage Done. That's probably my favorite Dark Tranquillity album, although pretty much anything from their late 90s to mid 90s period is particularly brilliant, but they're generally stay at high quality Dark Tranquillity. Obviously, At the Gates of the Daddies, Slaughter of the Soul is an album you must have in your life. And I'm a big Arch Enemy fan as well, and I would put Wages of Sin right up there in that band as well. Any other bands from the Melodeath realm?
Haunted, obviously. The Haunted.
I was going to say The Haunted. That's who I was going to say.
Yes. But the thing about In Flames and Soulwork, which they can do that no other band can do, is they can kind of get this poppy side. I mean, but still sound absolutely great. Like, I don't really like some of the later In Flames stuff, but I actually really like Where Roots Remain, which is the one where they kind of went off into poppy realms, because you can tell they're having so much fun and that there's such a sense of discovery. And I really love Figure Number 5 by Soulwork, where it's just like...
Great album.
Yeah, they're just... Like, Soulwork are like my metal band with a pop, with a kind of a pop awareness of choice. Like, and Figure Number 5 really kicked that off. But every album they've done is great. I love Bjorn Strid's voice. I love the kind of that really weird rubber drum sound they've got.
I think that Speed's kind of pop sensibilities have really come out, because he obviously went off and did Night Flight Orchestra, which is
absolutely love as well. All the Cheese, the new album Aeronautical, is so good.
Definitely. Any more to add to this smorgasbord of Melodeath?
Well, I mean, you know, considering how influential we said they were to metalcore and what happened in America, I think it's at least worth chucking in. I'm going to chuck in one band, and that band would be Darkest Hour, who I think are the closest band from the US to
great band.
That right?
Shadowfall, perhaps.
Well,
they were kind of a transition point.
I always thought Shadowfall were a little bit average, to be honest. Particularly when put up against something like The Haunted. I think, you know, God forbid, in Shadowfall, and there are a few others. For me, Darkest Hour captured the punk fury the most whilst being able to write wicked riffs. I would say that their first album, which no one really talks about, but is brilliant, Mark of the Judas, is probably, I would say, as close as America ever got to doing an early In Flames album.
Yeah. Their last album was fucking great as well, Darkest Hour.
There was a period where there was like loads of like really average Melodeath, mm-hmm. and there's so little worse than just
leave Stonic Syndicate alone.
Yeah. There's nothing more sort of disheartening than people just dutifully going through those classic Melodeath riffs without, you know, when you can tell they haven't probably even heard At the Gates, you know, that kind of third generation who just hadn't actually heard where it came from, and you could really tell when you heard them. I'm not mentioning any names.
No, they've already done it. Sonic Syndicate. I think I reviewed the last Sonic Syndicate album for the mag. That's always one where Jonathan Lee emailed me and go, what do you think of Sonic Syndicate? And I'm like, oh, just send it over, for God's sake. I'll do it. I'll do anything, Christ. But yeah, not good. Not good, man.
Not good at all. You ask the next question, Steve. I've just done loads of talking.
Okay, mate. How's lockdown been as a music journalist? There's likely been huge worries about the industry's visibility, but at the same time, you haven't had to go to 4 gigs a week, and you probably spent a lot more time at home. How have you found it? That's asked by Ben Wilmot. God, don't know where to start, really.
As somebody, it's quite funny that you said, well, you haven't had to go to 4 gigs a week. That's quite funny, because it's quite rare that someone would pick up on the idea of going to 4 gigs a week being a bad thing. But, you know, yeah, like the kind of grind of the music industry, like any industry, can be hard work sometimes, obviously. And it's obviously got its problems. But I'm missing gigs so bad. Really missing festivals. As a music journalist, I can only speak for Metal Hammer, really. Like, it's been hard at times. You know, we knew that people weren't going to shops, and so we knew that our sales were going to go down quite significantly, because literally no one was buying anything at one point. And so that meant that we had to pull our budgets right back. which meant that, you know, we weren't able to commission as many writers. You know, people like Steve weren't getting quite as much work at Metal Hammer at one point because Elle and I were having to literally write like everything. But that was really hard work. But, you know, we still feel very grateful to still be here and still feel like we're in a place where we're putting out issues we're proud of and we're putting our covers we're proud of. And I feel like we've come through the worst of that now. And when I say the worst of it, again, it was hard work and it's been hard for everybody. But obviously, we have a lot of friends and peers who have worked in the magazine music industry that have had it a lot harder than us in the last couple of months. So it could have been worse. But yeah, it's been a bit of a slog. And yeah, for me personally, like, you guys will have your thoughts as well. I've enjoyed a lot of the time at home. Some of it's been quite hard, but I've definitely re-engaged with vinyl in a big way. We're just talking about vinyl. I've enjoyed my gaming more. I got into basketball, which was nice. None of that's really to do with music journalism, but it's one of the good things about being able to work from home, I guess, during all this, because not everyone's been able to do that. Have you boys found it?
Well, I work from home anyway. So on one level, it hasn't changed that much. And so you kind of get used to, you know, working under lockdown. But then you kind of forget this whole other dimension that you're missing, which is like, you know, festivals. But it's not just the experience of the festivals themselves. But, doing this job is two things. One is a very solitary thing. You know, I'm writing, I'm subbing, I'm commissioning, I'm doing emails. And that's a very, you know, it's even those who all work in a team, that's a very, it still can be quite a solitary existence. But, you know, like going to festivals, and it's not just the festival itself, but the people that you see at all the festivals, like, you know, my Norwegian festivals, like Beyond the Gates or Midgardsblot or Inferno, you know, that's like kind of like my, you know, and I've got, you know, obviously in England, I've got that as well too. But, you know, that's kind of like my family, like my friends in there. And just like, so there's a whole dimension of community that it's kind of there, but it's a bit more of an abstract. And it's easy. So, and you get used to not having it, but it's a note that's not there in the air. And you kind of realize it, and you're missing something in yourself. And, you know, you work really hard, and when you go to festivals and you're in the thing, and you realize that this is the thing that keeps me sane.
Yeah.
Is having that kind of bigger sense of community and, you know, the friends where you kind of all share an experience and you all have the same kind of like language about how you perceive things. And missing that it's just like you've lost kind of some spectrum of your taste buds a little bit.
Mm. I get that. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, not being a kind of full-time person at the magazine, it's been, I mean, like I was working a full-time job in London. So my whole circumstances have changed massively from lockdown, because basically I did have a job which was kind of really linked to the music industry. And that, with a load of concerts that we were going to do, everything got cancelled. And suddenly I was like, oh, the company I was working for was folded. And I moved back to my village where I grew up. So that alone is weird. I had sort of said this year, having just got fatigued from so many years ago, and like 6 or 7 festivals a year, that I wasn't going to go to a festival this year. I was knackered from doing my own podcast, from doing this, you know, like, I very, very rarely would say no to anything either of you would like send over to me, like very, very, very rarely. And sometimes that got exhausting, like super exhausting. So it's been a little bit more, I've been a little bit more relaxed because, you know, like you said, Mel, I've had a little bit less to do, and that's fine. I understand why that is. But I am sort of itching to get back to like just doing more stuff, I guess. Like, it's been nice, you know, I'm living in the country now, sort of feel like I'm semi-retired. And I would love to, like, getting an email from Jonathan on a sort of 5:30 on a Friday going, sorry, this is like really, really late notice, but can you go to the underworld to review Annihilator? And I was like, oh man, I was going to go and have a pizza tonight with my girlfriend. And I got to text her and go, darling, I've got to go and review Annihilator. And some people might be going, oh, that's...
Hey, Annihilator if you're lucky.
Yeah, Corblacani or usually something like
that. Oh, yeah, yeah, oh my God. I just want to say this to everyone, but Steve is just like such a trooper. I don't know what I'd do without you.
I fucking love to get one of those emails now.
Yeah, I feel like I'm Trump and you're like a serviceman. Like my unit's like, sucker.
Honestly, like I would I've got to the point now where I welcome one of those emails, to be honest. And it's been cool. Like, it means, you know, I was working in the office before with a bunch of people who didn't want to listen to particularly challenging music, shall we say. So to be able to sort of wake up in the morning and listen to whatever I want to listen to has been really, really nice. And I think
girlfriends.
Yeah. Her headphones are on all the time. But mate, like, it's been, I think the other thing that's helped is it's been a really, really good year for music. Just in general, like, it has been a really, really good year.
Really, really, really fucking good, actually. There's a lot of, if I put together my top 10 albums of any genre this year, they would go toe-to-toe with a lot of the last few years, to be honest. Like, we'll probably do this on the end of year podcast, wherever you want, Steve, but, like, we've talked about the metal that's come out this year over and over again, obviously, but, you know, even with hip-hop, like, there's the Run the Jewels record. I've been smashing that Logic record over and over again. Like in pop music, there's been like the Duo album, the Gaga album, the Soyama album. It's just been...
On a pop front, also, Agnes Obel, that new album, absolutely amazing.
That came out the same week as the Hilary Woods album, and it was like the perfect for sort of sad girls week, like the definitive.
I absolutely love. I was going to go and see it live before the lockdowns happened. Just like,
And that's great. Actually, mentioned in the comments when you put the questions out about, am I allowed to include the Fiona Apple album in my albums of the year for Metal Hammer? And I'm probably not going to put it in, but I'm just going to say, man, that Fiona Apple album is the shit. It's unbelievable. So yeah, it's been a fucking awesome year for music, I think.
Absolutely splendid. It will carry us through. Alistair Belling says, which solo artist could carry the torch for heavy music over the next decade? I mean, that's
a bit weird. I mean, yeah. You don't expect solo artists to be classic, like traditionally heavy in the sort of like heavy sense, you know, in the sort of the metal sense.
Mm.
There are lots of solo artists who are heavy in a different sense.
I mean, I've got, like, cheekily, I've kind of noted down Tobias Forge because obviously he's not a solo artist, but Ghost is completely his baby and his project, and they are one of the great kind of exciting bands for the next decade, and wherever they go will probably 99% come out of his brain. So that's, I know, you know, they're fucking great musicians in that band, and they seem like a very solid unit now, but it's his thing and he will take that band to where it goes. So I'm kind of half counting that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just, I mean, we've had loads of, like, especially like female solo artists who are like doing some amazing stuff, you know, and it's really emotionally heavy. Like, obviously, A. Williams, Chelsea Wolf,
Leon Ignita.
Yeah, Emma Ruth Rundle.
Anna von Hauswolf's got an album.
Anna von Hauswolf, amazing. But probably the heaviest solo artist there is Jemana Galas. There's nothing more intense or scary than her. And she's just like, she's just at a place that no one else can reach. And I have never seen such like instinctive reactions of like, what the fuck? Like when she played Roadburn and you weren't allowed to leave, that they closed the bar while she played. And you weren't allowed to leave the main venue during a song. And I swear to God, it's like the first song was like, even by her standards, was off the scale. You know, she has ridiculously 4.5, maybe, I don't know, humongous octave range, and she's scary as fuck. I swear you can see people almost like climbing up the walls after the first song. It kind of, and just like, yeah, but where she's coming from is like, oh my, it's just so intense. And
I think
she's got a direct line to Down Below, and she can't.
I think you mentioned her before, but just because people always ask this, can you just say her name and spell it out slowly as well?
Yeah, so Jemana Galas, so D-I-A-M-A-N-D-A, and it's Galas, G-L-A, the second A has an acute accent on it, S. So she has two kind of forms. One is like a kind of like more bluesy form, like you can hear on an album like The Singer. Another one is just kind of a lot more avant-garde. She's sung about, you know, topics of like, you know, how people have, attitudes people have had towards people with AIDS, and uses a lot of biblical references. She has this kind of totally amazing, acrid, operatic voice that can go like super low to super high. She has an amazing way of playing the piano, just like absolutely rattles the keys. And like, she'll just, if you hear her voice, you'll be frozen to the spot. Like, you know, with some bluesy stuff, which is a bit more easier to listen to, or like Sri X, which is, even me, I've never seen the album in one sitting. But if you want to hear the more avant-garde side, listen to Plague Mass. That's her kind of her double album masterwork. Genuinely the most amazing artist on the planet. And
wow,
her talent is like another level from what you think another level is. It's and she just uses it with such absolute direct venom and power. And she's tiny. And it's like, in the same way that when you hear like Anna von Hausswolf thing, it's like, you can, like, how does that voice come from that body? It's just like, it's channeled from another dimension. Mm. And this, she's the kind of the source of it. So you can hear a lot of Dumela Galas in Anna von Hausswolf.
Wow.
And yeah, just genuinely one of the most powerful artists on the planet. And that's not even hyperbole.
So yeah, certainly in terms of carrying the torch for heavy music, being, you know, boundary pushing and exciting, that's some banging shouts. Any other thoughts on that, Steve? Or,
well, I mean, since I've said it a lot, my brain went to something a bit more contemporary, I guess, and that I think something that is like legitimately could be where heavy music and what is really, really popular in the mainstream now collides. Backwash would be one.
Mm.
I've spoken about a lot. I mean, there's still stuff like Perturbator and Carpenter Brute, who I think, if that scene, I don't know if that scene sort of feels like it might have stalled a little bit, because a few years ago that felt like, that whole kind of synthwave thing felt like a real big deal.
About 3 years ago, yeah. I feel like we'll see what happens. Like Perturbator and Carpenter Brute are both kind of releasing or yet to release kind of their next albums after that initial boom. So I think that would be very, excuse me, very telling about where that scene can actually go.
Funnily enough, Telok from Mayhem is just about to release his own synthwave project called Burgaton.
Good God!
Yeah, and it's got a pink cover as well.
Really?
It's pretty good.
Burgaton sounds like a transformer that turns into a Big Mac.
yeah. The album's called Miami Murder, and it's just not what we'd expect. Well, you know, you always expect the unexpected from Mayhem members.
Fair. All right. Let's move on. Do you want to take the next question, Jonathan, from Mark van der Velden?
I would actually like to take the following question because I have opinions on that.
Well, we all get opinions on them all. Yeah, but
okay. Mark van der Velden asks, what happens when super big bands die out, like physically die? What are we left with? Can rock music be seen as viable to the general public? Also, why is power metal frowned upon in the metal world?
Well, that's a camera, isn't it?
Yeah, just threw that one.
I feel like we've dealt with what happens next quite a lot. Maybe Mark hasn't listened to previous podcasts, but, you know, obviously we don't know exactly what's going to happen. We do know it is a fact that metal is not producing bands on the level of Metallica, Iron Maiden, Slipknot, Avenged Sevenfold. You know, we talked about Ghost being a big deal. Ghosts are a very big deal, but Ghosts are certainly not a big deal like Slipknot were a big deal in 2001. Like System of a Down were a big deal in 2001, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, you know, we've got a problem there. There's absolutely no doubt about it. I suspect the scene will probably, whether it's the festival scene or everything else, will probably have to evolve around that. And then hopefully it can grow again from there. But in terms of power metal, yeah, power metal really is frowned upon, isn't it? I can't think of anyone at Metal Hammer, certainly not on staff. And, you know, there's not a lot of diehard power metal fans.
We have quite a few writers who really like it. Chris Chandler.
Yeah, sorry. In the writers, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Through the years I've been at Hammer, I can't think of many of us.
Have been I, think, what people outside of metal think metal is, people inside of metal think, well, that's what power metal is. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, we think like, if, like, you know, you think it's like, you know, people who aren't into metal and they just look at power, like people, you'll see this on the Guardian comments pages whenever that metal gets mentioned. People just think it's like, you know, 40-year-olds living with their mums, and it's silly, and it's ridiculous, and they'll have to do with the real world. And I think, you know, a lot of metal people think that's what power metal is. But, you know, power metal is a kind of a misnomer as well, because when power metal first came out, it was something different. Like, power metal used to mean something completely different. It was speed metal. And there was this kind of like, slowly it kind of morphed into this kind of fluffy dragons and you know, swords and everything else aspects to it. But power metal was originally speed. That's what you used to call speed metal. But then, you know, you had this weird thing how, like, when Dragon Force came along, and suddenly loads of young kids were into it, you know, mixed, you know, it had this, it was kind of a bit more aware of its own absurdity, and it was a lot more playful with it. And, you know, had all those kind of video game squelches in it. And there's suddenly, like, loads of young kids were into sort of power metal because of Dragon Force. And then, you know, you had bands like Tour Assass, who had that part, you know, an element of that in there. But it was much more knowing, and it became, yeah, a bit more kind of fun and engaging, rather than sort of just super serious and not being aware, and not having that kind of self-awareness that you tend to think a lot of power metal has.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because I, like, you know, we very proudly kind of rep for all metal here on the podcast. And during, when we started doing the album of the week, I think very early on, we did that band Brothers of Metal, because Elle and I wanted to be like, look, we're gonna cover all types of metal here. But it's a weird one, because I still like Sabaton. I still sometimes listen to some of those mid-noughties Dragon Force albums. I used to like power metal quite a lot. I used to listen to like Ed Guy and all those kind of bands. But it's always been the genre that gets probably quite a lot of unfair snidiness towards it from within metal, which is so weird, because metal's supposed to be, if nothing else, we're supposed to be the outsiders. We're supposed to be like, we don't care about being cool, right? Like, we're metalheads. We don't care about what's fashionable. But power metal, it's kind of like, yeah, but not that unfashionable. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just kind of gets pushed out
at the beginning, yeah.
Which is very strange.
But I don't mind power metal when it goes beyond absurdity and comes out the other end. Like, I actually, obviously, probably because I was seeing them in Wacken, but I kind of enjoyed a Power Quest set. Because it's so, like... When it gets past that kind of point of silliness, you kind of get with the joke. It's why I don't like all sort of folk metal, but I love Trollfest, because it goes beyond ridiculousness and it becomes this kind of hyper real thing of like absurdity. And it's just, yeah, when it kind of boils over into kind of absurdity, I can enjoy it on the absolute delirium of like of absurdity level. But that's the only times I've... But, you know, I like some Blind Guardian records because I think it goes beyond absurdity into something else. And I quite like some Iced Earth. But, but I'm not a connoisseur on it. It just... I kind of think a lot of it's a bit silly.
I mean, it is definitely silly, but as you said, proudly silly. Steve's been quiet so far. He's looking like he's warming up a take.
It's just not heavy, is it? I mean, like, I think if you're going to go on about... At this point, as we sit here in 2020, metal can be so many things, but for the most part, like, the stuff that excites me about heavy music is it being heavy. And if you're going to talk about how you slayed the dragon for metal, and metal is this, you know, we are the definition and definitive metal band because of the way we dress, because we talk about fucking dragons or whatever, I sort of think, well, metal's kind of gone way, way, way beyond that, and it is genuinely heavy. And I think there's, like, I get the sort of some of the sort of ironic, like, I mean, if you're liking something ironically already, I'm like, nah, don't like
it. But you should never like metal anything, like, it's not the metal code to like anything ironically, to have distance from stuff.
Yeah, I think there are people who are like, ha ha, I've got a plastic shield, ha 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 ha. And, you know, like that, the kind of like Rainbow and Dio and where it comes up, obviously Judas Priest, are ridiculous. Like there, you look at it and you go, what I love about this is it is the sort of the inherent ludicrousness of hard rock or heavy metal pumped up to peacocking levels, you know?
But it's still got metal riffs.
Yeah, and that kind of fuck you fronting that old school original strand of power metal had, I have absolutely no issue with that whatsoever. I think that's
awesome.
When you start dressing up and doing like Nintendo core and playing with battle axes, but then sneering at a band like, I don't know. Pick any new metal band, pretty much. I mean, even not any new metal band, but even when new metal is like, no.
Any new metal band, Steve. Any new metal band.
But you can't laugh at Mudvayne when you're waving a plastic sword around and a big fucking Viking hat and listening to.
Yeah, I just.
And claiming like, oh, I'm, you know, like I'm the proper metal. This is what metal's supposed to be. And it's like, well, you look like as much like.
It was. Yeah.
You look as much of a dickhead as the bloke in the baggy trousers with the big, like, blue chin strap beard. Like, fuck off. And I think that attitude, which is definitely something in power metal, you know, you see it on the Bloodstock forum every year once they announce any band who aren't, you know, who might have been on Roadrunner Records at any point. And you just think, like, mate, the stuff you're talking about, it sounds like status quo with it. You know what I mean? I watch Sabaton. It's like, this sounds like more like Roxette than it does black metal. Like, you're not even heavy. You're not even heavy. Like, fuck, this is fucking, you're like, I'm all for having fun. I love pop music. But don't tell me that this, like, silly pop thing that you're doing is proper music and that I'm a fucking poser or a faker.
Yeah. I mean,
come on.
Yeah, I mean, bear in mind that Bloodstock was originally a power metal festival when it was indoors. But my issue with power metal, like bad power metal, it's the same issue I kind of have with bad new metal. And it's not whether it's heavy or not. It's just this kind of self-serving oversincerity that I find really grating, but that's not unique to power metal. But it's just there's a lot of it in power metal.
Yeah, but at least bad new metal gave us like infinite one-hit wonders. I mean, bad power metal never gave us like a Bodies. You know what I mean?
Because it never took on in England in the same way that took over in took on in say Germany or Italy. So you know, all these bands were huge, and you know, Italy's huge for power metal, Germany's huge for power metal, you know, we're talking from a very English perspective. And you know, on my previous magazine, you know, Nuclear Blast would always like go to me, why are you not cover these bands? It's, you know, it's just they're not.
Yeah, when the count from Sesame Street was MD of Nuclear Blast.
Yeah. But this is back, you know, this is kind of like in the early 2000s. Just like, because in England, we don't do power metal in the same way that they do in Germany. You know, it's just not, it hasn't taken root in the way that it has.
Until Dragon Force came along, which really was a phenomenon.
Yeah, Germany was like, had this kind of force of gravity where like the 80s can't escape. It was like a black hole.
That's fine, you know what I mean, that shit's fine. I think if you put power metal on and you go, do you know what, all this is really super catchy, high camp, you know, like fucking Dio taken to the absolute nth degree, and it's just like a fun cool thing, that is fine. But like you say, Jonathan, that kind of self-serving, I am a warrior of heavy metal and you with your Lamb of God albums are a piece of shit, like that really puts me off power metal massively.
Yeah,
it really does, and I think that is, you know, there are some power metal bands who I listen to and I think are good, but again, it's really like, you know, I think you go back, like you said, you go back to the source of it, you go back to the root of it, that kind of speed metal thing or how it was evolving in the early 80s, and a lot of those bands are good and they sound hard and they, you know, like you. Yeah, you don't think, oh, this is a joke, you know, like, or like they've got their tongue in their cheek. You know, someone like Sabaton, I'm like, are you serious or are you not serious? Are you serious and your fans are laughing at you when you're trying to be, or are you laughing at your fans? I don't know. It just feels like somebody's got their tongue rammed so fucking hard in their cheek at this point, and I don't know who it is, that I'm out.
Yeah, but I love, like, I love reading Chris when he writes, Chris Chandler, when he writes about Paramel, because, like, seeing the love and the non-judgmental love he has for some of these bands, you know, he knows what's good and what's bad, but I find that really contagious. You know, I can't always share it in the same way that I can't really do Manowar, but I really appreciate people who do, like Dom, who loves Manowar, and but it's not me.
It should be as well, and I think that's what the dynamic kind of Steve was talking about with nu metal. It's probably why there's been even more of a backlash against it for metalheads of a certain generation, because, you know, I grew up a nu metal kid. My first proper metal album was Chocolate Starfish, and that era when, you know, obviously I look back at, you know, of course Fred Durst is ripe for piss taking, and he deserved a lot of it because he embraced that and he played up to his silliness. But, you know, once you kind of get to that thing where you are being told, oh, no, you're not into metal. No, you're not part of this club because you like that. And then you're kind of, you're listening to like Here to Stay by Korn. And then you look over at like...
Hey, Nonny, Nonny.
Yeah, like, exactly. Hey, Nonny, Nonny. You look over at a bit of Ed Guy or something and you're just like, well, yeah, okay. Like, I guess so. But I mean, we should all be able to just celebrate all of it and like all of it, really. But that's another thing about metal. We all fucking love ripping the shit out of each other. So there we go. The tribes remain at war, apparently, until you actually get out into the real world and go to a festival and you see that everyone's actually friends and it's fine.
Yeah. I mean, it's fun seeing some of these bands at Wacken, particularly.
Yeah, definitely. And then Wacken's a great example of that. At Wacken, you will see, or at Bloodstock, you will see a band like Aylstorm have a big, like, kind of the party hour, and everyone loves that. But then you will now also see Parkway Drive turn up, and everyone's into that as well. Like, there, it is possible. A better world is possible.
I think that's why, you know, I do go like, yeah, the world's fucking moved on. Like you say, I am aware of the history of Bloodstock and what it used to be, but they've been booking Rob Zombie and Trivium and Lamb of God for fucking years now. So, I mean, when they did have Avantasia subbing Lamb of God a few years ago, I think about 9 people watched Avantasia. It was like, and fuck, do you remember that? And you just think, well, you've got to allow these people in as well, as much as anything, surely.
But conversely, Evil Scarecrow got more people than Emperor did.
Yeah. Yes. Although I actually enjoyed it. I actually quite enjoyed Evil Scarecrow at Wacken.
So did about 30,000 other people, inexplicably. So there we go. I can't help but respect the game.
Yeah. And Emperor got hardly any. Didn't have a particularly big crowd at Wacken either, which I was a bit offended by.
It's almost like a lot of people that kind of bang on about that kind of stuff are actually being posers or something, isn't it? Not to understate.
Yeah, I think it's
one of the most important metal bands of all time. Yeah, obviously,
the crowd you've got.
You know what I'm getting at. Right, one more question then. Jan Ryland asks, hi all, hope you're doing well. We hope you're doing well too. I've noticed that Black Veil Bride seems to get a bit of stick, both on this podcast, I can't remember the last time we talked about them on this podcast, and in the metal community more broadly. As a fan, I struggle to get my head around this, as in my opinion, they write catchy songs, are technically proficient, and genuinely passionate about quote-unquote metal. Is it to do with being derivative? And then Jan points out that, by the way, my name is pronounced Jan, as I've heard it mispronounced a couple of times on the podcast before. Sorry, Jan. We will not do that again. Our bad. Black Veil Brides. I sense we're probably all on the same side with this band. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I'm going to be fairly late about this. I think there's one adjective for them, which is risable.
Okay.
They're just a risable entity.
I'm going to be as objective as I may ever have been about anything ever about Black Veil Brides. And I'm going to say, I think, personally, and objectively speaking, their music is rubbish, right? they are rubbish. I think, objectively, they are rubbish, right? They're not a good band. They're not anything I want to listen to at all. But I really like Andy Biersack, Andy Black. I think Andy Biersack is actually a very, very good figurehead for that group of people from that scene. I think he is clearly, he's from a punk rock background. I've interviewed him before. He was talking to me about Misfits and Millions of Dead Cops and Nation of the Ulysses and like proper fucking underground hardcore punk, right? So he really, really likes that shit. But he wants to be a rock star, and fucking fair play to him. He looks good. He's incredible. He's got cheekbones like above his ears. The guy is incredibly good looking. Of course, he's going to, in a poppy rock stroke glam metal thing, and whatever Black Veil Brides are, he has, he's got loads of charisma, and he is, you know, they're not good. I don't like their music at all, but if they're going to gravitate to something or someone, and that happens to be Andy Black, and he goes on to say, you should check out the Misfits, and they go on to maybe listen to something good, then I got no real big beef with Vibes. Like, I mean, to be
honest, they are definitely a derivative band, and I don't think they even pretended otherwise. You know, Andy essentially kind of had a vision for this band that they could be this kind of modern day Motley Crue, but kind of super polished for kind of pre-teen metal fans, basically, which is fine. And I think that worked. And I think they had a moment where, I mean, I wish that you could go to, most metal bands do have a significant young following as well. But anytime I go see a band from this generation or the last, let's say the last 10 years or so, and you go and look at their crowd and it's a really young, super passionate crowd, I always think that's fucking great. And that's what you want. And they tapped into, however they did it, they tapped into that more than 99% of heavy rock bands that have tried to kind of make a name for themselves and managed in the last 20 years. And was a lot of it cynical? Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. Again, I don't even know if Andy would deny that anymore. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was all so carefully orchestrated and put together. But it's just, as soon as that band turned up, I was just like, this isn't for me. It's not aimed at me. It's not for me.
It's such an anodyne take. And I've got nothing against bands being derivative, but you just got to give, you have to kind of give something back, some awareness of the lineage. Because if you're not aware of that lineage, you're not going to channel any of it, even if you make it for a younger audience. So I can only really kind of talk from experience with Black Veil Brides, and one of my most miserable festival experiences was I was covering Download, I think, for Classic Rock, our sister magazine. And so it was one of those really rainy downloads. I remember like watching on the main stage in the rain, Disturbed, and just like basically taking Tool, wringing out all the emotion and the art and just giving you the rag of what's left. And I just like, oh God. And then I had to trudge up the hill in the mud to the second stage, see Black Veil Brides. I'm just like, oh my God, this band, they're leeching everything that makes me feel alive about rock and roll music. And I was just drawing all the genuine power out of it and just giving you this shiny sort of, you know, surface of what's left. And it's just like, oh God. And it's just like, the one thing that saved me that day was just like, later on that stage, The Cult played. And it's like, this is a rock and roll riff. It's not rocket science. Go straight to the fucking source. Just play a riff and it resonates. And the two things that really saved me, and unfortunately they're playing at the same time, I had to, by way of contrast, I had to keep going backwards and forwards because I couldn't miss those bands, were like them. And in the third stage, Heat, you know, those young Swedish guys playing super cheesy AOR. But the reason I love Heat is because it's so uncynical. And the love for what they do just comes out so much. And so both those things were such a complete antidote to this kind of risible, taking credit for something that you have no investment in, that was Black Veil Brides.
Yeah, but Jonathan, I have to say, that's not a new thing for sort of this generation. I don't think that's a new, I think, I mean, I would say everything you've just said about Black Veil Brides, I would say about Motley Crue. I think they are atrocious, an atrocious band with absolutely no redeeming qualities whatsoever. Linkin Park. I think Linkin Park have no redeeming qualities whatsoever. But I think both of those bands, although they are absolutely cynical, horrible. Merlin's going to shake his head clean off his neck.
I mean, I know for a fact that Linkin Park they were cynically marketed, and of course everyone around them knew something was big, but I know for a fact that band were not put together by those members in the same way that Black Veil Brides were.
Okay, yeah, but that's neither here nor there, I don't think. I think the point is those both Motley Crue
and also, to be fair, just to make another point, Hybrid Theory is one of the most influential albums. Well, it's one of the most influential albums of the last 20 years, and Black Veil Brides will never lay claim to something like that.
Well, I mean, my point being, if both Motley Crue, I think people who grew up listening to Motley Crue and people who grew up listening to Linkin Park, both of them probably heard that as the first thing, got really, really inspired, and then they went and they found the amount of like good bands who say they're inspired by Linkin Park, the amount of good bands who said, oh, you know, I really love Motley Crue, they are there. So, I mean, I you can say whatever you want about both those bands. I think they're both appalling, and I don't think Black Veil Brides are either any better or worse than either of them. But, you know, but there's a place where that shit like that happens, and it is influential, and it can transcend onto something else all the time.
I mean, the one thing I'll say about Motley Crue, whether you like them or not, is that they totally embodied a place and a time. In a way, you know, that there was very much a product and of that kind of era and that particular, you know, part of the world. And, you know, but Black Veil Brides were so, they're so marketed and, you know, they're so disconnected from any of that kind of bloodstream that, you know, that you know, you're never going to remember a Black Veil Brides songs in the way that you remember like a Motley Crue song. You know, Motley Crue were what they were, but I just thought that Black Veil Brides were kind of a facade.
Yeah, but I mean, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. I mean, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. I think the way Black Veil Brides have come through in a completely different world to the world that Motley Crue came through in,
I'm not, they're leeching off of that of what Motley Crue came from, but not really channeling any of that. It was kind of sexless as well.
Yeah, but that might be a good thing. I mean, I think they're aiming for, you know, in the 2010s to have a sort of sexless version of Motley Crue for young kids. I mean, it's not what I want to listen to, but is it? I mean, yeah, I'm certainly not picking up for them like as a sort of musical entity. But all I'm saying is, big bands with not a lot going for them get big a lot of the time. It's sure. In every genre, and it doesn't sort of, I don't think it signals the death knell for anything really. I think it can just be these young people have found a thing that they really like that they might through nostalgia listen to, you know, for the rest of their lives. I've got like Britpop bands that I fucking love because I bought the album when I was 14, who are just like shit versions of Blur. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I've got the Republica album and I'm like, oh, the Republica album, like no one needs that.
Can I just say something about Britpop? Like, because Britpop did actually kill off everything that was interesting in the 80s. Like literally, I was on Melody Maker.
We were getting way sidetracked here, by the way.
Yeah, we were covering Sonic Youth and lots of really avant-garde stuff. So I'm just saying, the point I'm trying to make is that really shit stuff can, when it gets really popular, can kill off the momentum of something much more interesting that was going on before it. So these things, I'm not saying Black Veil Brides, they're just shit in their own unique way, in their own little bubble. I don't think they're like a harbinger of doom or anything. But really shit, overly marketed stuff really can kill off something really genuinely interesting and organic that preceded it. Yeah, so don't be complacent about this. And Britpop did that to indie music.
Yeah, so
made it super white, super less of difference, and super kind of very cis male kind of thing. Whereas there's so much more interesting stuff going on in the indie world back then, and Britpop killed it off dead. I hate Britpop.
We're not going to have a Britpop argument because I was going to say there's a whole thing that goes anyway. Jonathan, another time.
I'll tell you what you should do. You should get Jonathan on the Right Hack podcast, and you can talk about Britpop and shit there because you do all that stuff. So.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah.
He'd be very well placed to say. No, I think you've
got the Rocky theme tune in my head.
I think the other thing about Black Veil Brides for me is that they're just not as, obviously there is a generation of rock fans that will look back on them like my generation looks back on Linkin Park, like the 80s generation looks back on Motley Crue. But I don't think, because they were so out of time, I don't think they embodied any kind of generation. Like Linkin Park were part of a scene which completely changed music forever, and Motley Crue were part of a scene that kind of cast a shadow over, you know, American rock music for decades. Whereas it's not like, I mean, you know, you could put Asking Alexandria into that bracket a little bit, but it's not like there was suddenly this whole new generation of glam rock bands that completely, you know, it's the same as how like My Chemical Romance, someone might go, oh yeah, they're basically the same thing, but they're not really, because they were so fucking big and like they were generational defining. Just don't think Black Veil Brides were that. But again, they weren't for us. And, you know, I don't want to be patronizing. There's plenty of adult people that like Black Veil Brides as well. But if I had a young son or daughter and they were into Black Veil Brides, I'd be like, awesome. Like, we got somewhere to work with here. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. They are shit, though.
Oh, yeah, I don't know them, so whatever.
But you put young kids 80s stuff and they get it immediately.
Yeah.
You can take them straight to the source.
Go straight to the source. Skip everything else. Listen, we've been blabbing on for ages. It's been a long podcast this week, but I appreciate it, guys. Thanks for coming on. We will be back next week. Let's plan another Hall of Fame. We haven't done one for a while, so we'll get one planned out for that. In the meantime, brand new issue of Metal Hammer is out right now. Go pick it up. Be safe. And I'm going to talk some more while I work out how to stop recording, because we're doing it on a different thing. There it is. See you next week, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye. Goodbye.